Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Coogan Chronicles, a podcast where two former child actors
interview other former child actors
about what it was like growing up in the spotlight. I'm your co-host, AJ Trouth.
And my name is Chris Marquette.
And we're going to talk to you today about child acting and what it's all about. We have a great...
people about what it's all about. They know what it's about. You know it.
Listen, I'm struggling here. I don't do the intro usually. You do the intro. I don't know what the heck I'm saying.
You don't.
I'm winging it.
Words right now. Yeah. We're off the rails already.
But this much is true. This much is true. We do have a very great, exciting guest for you today. This is somebody that as soon as we came up with the concept of doing this podcast, we knew for a fact we had to have her on here. And she's sort of an authority figure on the entire subject.
I don't know what she would think if we said that to her. But she is. I don't know if she may or may not even realize that. So it's Mara Wilson, which I'm sure you know if you've clicked on the episode and are listening to this right now. But yeah, I mean, Mara is the only former kid actor that we know of that's written a book about her experiences as a kid actor and that I believe shed light really beautifully on the life of any former kid actor. You know, I think it was something not just about her. I think it really sort of reflects what a majority of former kid actors would go through. So in that sense, she's the authority.
Yes. And it's a very well-written book. The thing that I appreciated so much, I didn't actually read it. I got the book on tape, which was even better because Mara reads it, is that she was able to articulate so many of the things that are swimming around in my head about this subject that I have a difficult time just, you know, putting into the proper words. She broke it all down. She has a very clear, almost like psychoanalyzing the entire brain of the former child actor.
She's basically the therapist every former kid actor needs to become adults. That we needed. Maybe she got that sense halfway through our interview.
I wish her book came out like 10, 15 years ago. We could have just
I know. It. Yeah. If you're a kid actor, you're out there, you haven't been listening, just check this out before you go much further. You'll know what's in store for you and you know how to get through the challenges. But, you know, there's something she did do one thing for sure, I think, for me in the vein of that, in that idea, which is she really beautifully said to us here, she talked about how she felt so good about this medium, about this podcast that we put together, because she felt it gave former kid actors the platform to tell their own narratives, to tell their own stories. And that prior to this kind of thing, there wasn't that avenue. She felt that most, if not all kid actors had their stories told for them. That's the way she put it. And I thought, God, we could have never said that better. And I'm so glad she said it that way, because it's exactly in much better words, what you and I have been saying from the get-go of this whole thing, you know, is that, you know, we felt like there was a space that we wanted to hold for all the stories and experiences that people that had, you know, grown up performing have and carry with them and feel like they're just going to get lost in the ether. So it was really cool for her to pick up on that and champion that with us here and put such beautiful, eloquent words to that sentiment, as she does with pretty much anything she talks about.
It's true. Now, I completely agree with everything you just said. And the conversation was so wonderful. We just kept talking and kept talking. And we decided ultimately to make it into two episodes. So this is part one of Mara Wilson. And without further ado, here's Mara.
Did you just steal my last little tagline thing?
I did the intro. Is that okay?
But you got to give it a little flair.
I know. I kind of hesitated. I wasn't sure.
Yeah, you didn't. I know.
Okay, you do it. You do it.
Try it again. No. Just jump in there. Just jump in there. Just give it a little, give it some confidence.
And without, this is how I feel like you would
say. These are acting lessons for
me. This is how I feel you would do it.
Okay.
Without further ado, we give you Mara Wilson.
Like I'm fucking Ace Ventura, the detective. Yeah,
that's how.
All right,
guys. That's how I feel like.
Enough of us two. Enjoy Mara Wilson. Hi, Mara.
Hi. Hi.
Thanks for coming on.
No, my pleasure. I'm so happy to see you guys.
It's really nice to see you.
I know, it really is.
Chris and I have been anticipating this, and you know, really excited for this all coming together and you coming on. So this is, you know, a big moment for us.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have been, I think we've been more excited and anticipated talking to you more than literally anybody, I think.
Oh my God.
And no, that's no, truly. I don't know, actually, I don't know if you're ready for the onslaught of compliments and awe and admiration we're going to throw at you today. We're going to like,
I mean, the feeling is mutual, you know, like well, that's I was nice. So thrilled to hear. I was so thrilled to hear from you, Chris. And I was just like, this is, I, you know, I immediately told my publicist, I was like, no, I know these guys. This is good.
They're so not weird. Yeah,
exactly. Cause I get a lot of podcast requests cause anybody could record a podcast.
Yeah.
So
yeah, exactly.
But I was just like, no, it's cool. I know who these guys are. It's going to be great. And they're great. So yeah.
Well, we're really honored. We really, really are. I mean, Mara, you're like, I really think you are. Well, I don't know if you realize this, but aside from my opinion of you, which is like you're on a big pedestal, I think. I just think as a human being and definitely the biggest pedestal of former kid actor, because I don't know if you know this, but like you might be the only former child actor who is spoken at length about being a former kid actor. I think that and has spoken in such beautiful thoughtful ways about being a former
kid. With just such incredible insight.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's a world where we don't really get to, I think for a long time, we have not controlled our own narratives. Yeah. There's been the narrative around us, and it's for a long time, it's been, well, first it was, you know, terrible things happening like to Jackie Coogan. And then it was a lot of, you are an object to be pitied. Or yeah. You are, for a long time, it was derisive. It was, you know, we were seen as risible. We were jokes. So yeah. We're kind of either seen as objects of derision or objects of pity. And that's not, you know, all that we are, yeah. You know?
Not
we're
at all.
And yeah. it's much more balanced than that. And there's so many misconceptions. So it's something that I feel like people really need to hear from us. I feel like there are so many things where people are like, let's talk to child actors. But the thing is, I pretty much only want to talk to other child actors about child acting, which is why I was recently in the documentary Showbiz Kids with Alex Winter, because Alex Winter was a child actor himself. And he was in Bill and Ted, and he was in so many like teen movies and things like that. And so I was like, oh, okay, you're going to know what it's like. And he did, and he was wonderful to work with, just the kindest, most empathetic guy and a great filmmaker. And it's just like, if you weren't a part of it, you kind of don't get it, I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
And I was born in Burbank. And yeah. And like I took a meeting at Disney, I think it was a couple of years ago. And they were like, oh, you're from here, right? And I said, I can point to the hospital I was born at out this window. It's across the street.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the first time AJ and I ever hung out was at the Burbank Mall.
Yes.
With a mutual child actor friend. It was like, I'm going to meet AJ outside of PF Chang's. You want to go? Like that was my stomping ground. Yeah. I mean, my first introduction, I moved from Jersey, but the first place I ever landed in LA was the Burbank Airport. And then I went to the Holiday Inn near the Burbank Mall, and that was my home.
Yes. Yeah, really? Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. That's it.
I recently thought, I was like, you could do a whole thing about the Holiday Inn in Burbank.
You can. Yeah. You can. Holiday Inn story. Yeah.
Like, I was like, that would be like a good movie to make in quarantine. Like,
yeah.
Like just Holiday Inn stories.
Specifically the Burbank Holiday Inn.
Specifically the Burbank one. Because
I feel like it's a little magnet for entertainment industry folk and, you know, and a lot of, probably a lot of former kid
actors.
Well,
and the expectations of what Hollywood, the people that get to the Burbank Holiday Inn, their expectations of what Hollywood is so different from what Hollywood actually is.
Exactly.
And that is just going on in that one place. It's this unique microcosm.
Then you move on to the Oakwood Apartments, and the Oakwoods actually show you a little bit more what it's like for
exactly.
For
better or worse. Now you're officially on the hill instead of over it.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. We all share Burbank in common. I think we have a ton of friends in common. And
people don't believe me when I'm like, they're like, how did you get into child acting? I'm like, everybody did it. I was
everybody
not the only
it.
One in my class who did it. There were so many other kids. And there was like a hierarchy, like in middle school, especially there was a hierarchy of who the cool kids was. Cause like my parents wanted to keep me in kids movies because they were scared about what happened to a lot of young actresses. And they thought there weren't a lot of good kids movies out there. So they were like, keep doing kids movies for as long as you can. But that was considered uncool by the time I got to seventh grade because the cool kids were in the Gap ads. And the cool kids were models. And they weren't in baby movies like I was.
Yeah,
so,
that's so funny.
Yeah, that is
so funny. Yeah, we've talked a bit. I mean, I want to ask you about that later because I know there's, you know, there is this part of being a kid actor where your school life and your peers and your social life starts to affect how you want to work and, yeah. and what context you want to work, because there is the there is this strange social pressure that starts. I mean, for me, it started when I entered high school and then I did an episode of Seventh Heaven and a bunch of kids saw it and literally beat the living shit out of me because they're like, look at this yeah. kid that's on. And I stood up for myself and it started a fist fight. But it was that was a turning point for me where I was like, I think I'm going to be a little pickier about where I put my face. You know, like,
yeah.
I didn't realize everybody's watching and it's no longer just like an acting job.
It was, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's there were so many kids. I knew so many kids who were on Seventh Heaven. Like it was, oh, yeah. that was also yeah. a big thing.
Seventh Heaven, Malcolm in the Middle. Yeah.
Malcolm in the Middle. Everyone was on Malcolm in the Middle too. Yes.
There's certain shows you have to go through as a rite of passage. Seventh Heaven's one of them. Everyone has to do like a CSI. Doesn't matter which one, but you have to do a CSI.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Just like every Broadway. If you see a Broadway show in the playbill, everybody's in one Law and Order or another. Yeah. And sometimes multiple exactly. Law and Orders. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So if you're lucky, both
yeah.
of them.
Yeah.
So AJ and I read your book recently.
Well, I did the book on tape, which I highly recommend. Yeah. The book
on tape
is awesome because you read it and you're just hearing your voice tell your story was excellent. So I'm glad that I chose to go the book on tape route.
Thank you. I mean, I love voiceover. I've always loved it. And I loved recording my audiobook. It was one of the most fun experiences of my life.
Well, I didn't listen to audio, but I could hear you so strongly in your writing. I could hear every part of your charisma and depth, and I think your really biting sense of humor. And it really took me, you know, it took me by surprise from the moment I started, and mm-hmm. and then I got really used to it and really loved it. And I, you know, I read your book. It was really, I don't know if it was like this for AJ, but for me, it was a really emotional ride, and not just with your personal story, but it was really emotional. There's something. I don't even know this is like weird to put on this podcast or even like say to you, but there was something that really connected me in your story to my own past as a kid actor. And it took me a few days when I was done reading the book, it took me a few days where I finally said to myself, I think, you know, for me, my life as a kid actor, it got very disconnected at a certain point. When I became a young adult, I sort of lost connections with my own mother. I lost connections with this guardian that I had, that had been bringing me to sets and to work and to auditions for a long time. I switched managers from my kid manager to a new one and agents and stuff. So my sort of little security bubble of adults and people changed really quickly and really dramatically. And ever since it really disconnected me from that part of my life. It really did.
Yeah.
Until I read your book. Until I literally read your book. And then I like, suddenly I was like, oh yeah, I've taken trips just like that. Oh yeah, that's exactly what it was like the first time I hung out with kid actors. Oh my God, that's it. Like it just, it like really, really deeply resonated and moved me in more ways than I can say really easily. And I think with words, but I'm in awe. I left feeling like you are like Zen and the art of child actor. Like that's also
that's a
what
great
your
way
book
to put it.
I'm far from Zen. I'm an anxious person. I would be an anxious person even if I weren't a child actor. But yeah. I think that there's a lot about it where I'm just kind of like, okay, I accept it. You know, I accept it for what it is.
That's what I told AJ. I said, you know, I read and I said, you know what moves, I'm in such admiration with you about is you seem like you contended with everything that came your way inside. Everything internally came your way and you contended with it and you got in the ring with it and you made peace and accepted everything about your life and about where it moved and about where it had been. And it's so amazing. People don't always do that, or they spend way longer trying to go down that road. And I'm sure that it hasn't stopped because you're still alive and you're here and you're, you know, you're a human being, but you came out the other side, I think, in a way that I would hope any former kid actor comes out the other side, regardless of what their life looks like.
You know, I love hearing this, but the truth is that I feel like a lot of this stuff didn't happen until I wrote the book. You know, like there were so many parts of the book. Some parts of the book were, kind of sprung out of my head, fully formed like Athena, with like the issues that I had with a lot of child acting definitely came up while I was writing it. Like probably the hardest thing to write and the thing that I worked on my editor with on the most was the letter to Matilda, which is something that my favorite teacher in college told me to do. She said, I think you should write a letter to Matilda, because I think that that would help you a lot. And so thank you, Marlene, for telling me to do that. And that I had so many things in there where my editor was like, okay, well, I'm not quite understanding what you're saying here. And I had to think, well, what am I saying here? What am I, you know,
So it wasn't, your book wasn't, I had assumed, because it is so clear and is so, your perspective on yourself and the world is to me, so brave and full and whole and not sort of, I don't wonder that. I don't sit there listening, what is she saying? Or what is she still wrestling with that she's not quite aware of? Or like you seemed like you had found some issues. You went through, or not even issues. You found experience. You understood the experience and you grew from that experience. And that's how that whole book comes across.
And for us, for Chris and I, it was this feeling of you were able to clearly articulate a lot of the abstract ideas that we have running around our heads as it pertains to child acting and wanting to be able to communicate, and is a big impetus for doing this show. But you so clearly articulated all of those ideas, and that was amazing to be able to listen to.
I mean, thank you. I think some of it is just who I am. I think that I am a very verbal person and I am a very obsessively analytical person. And so I'm forever asking myself why, you know, and I think I was a pretty philosophical kid to begin with. I was always like, I never lived an unexamined life. You know, I couldn't. So I've been looking at myself and trying to be objective about my life for a very long time. And I also think that I had a lot of friends and family. I mean, I was lucky. Like, my immediate family are really wonderful people and they're very understanding, and they are people that I can, you know, rely on. I talk to my brothers and sisters every day, and, you know, and my dad is a very loving guy, and, you know, and my stepmother too. Like, they're people who I can rely on. And I'm really lucky to have had that. So I think that with that, and also just with my own, you know, tendency to analyze everything, that's, you know, that's how I ended up here. That was just, that's just kind of my personality type, I guess.
That totally makes sense. I will add to that. I mean, maybe you don't realize that you sort of almost undersell yourself in that, you know, a big catalyst for AJ and I wanting to put this podcast together was the idea that it was twofold. We felt like there's a lot about a former kid actor's life that goes unsaid and that kind of lives and dies with former actors. I just don't think anybody's going to ask us about stuff. So we wanted to do that. And that's the plain and simple thing. But the other thing we really wanted to do was explore how the life of a former kid actor affects a person's psyche and what they contend with as adults and how that shapes their life. And you... I think through your own experience and lens, whether you realize it or not, you really understand the kid actor, not just you and yourself, but the kid actor. And that's what was so incredible about your book as well.
Well, it's something I feel strongly about. And I think it's also, for a long time for me, there was this idea where I was like, it was kind of the I'm not like the other girls thing, but I think there was sort of an I'm not like the other child actors thing to myself, you know. And I think it was because my parents wanted to keep me like a normal child as much as they could. So they were like, well, other child actors are like this. And I think there was, and it frustrates me so much and it upsets me so much that I internalized that. That I internalized this idea of that, you know, we're all brats and we're all spoiled. And it's so funny because every time I worked with other child actors or I met other child actors, like, they were wonderful. You know, there were ones who weren't always the easiest people to get along with, but that's everywhere, you know, everyone of every age, and especially children. There's going to be some who are harder to get along with than others, or people that you just don't have a lot in common with. But the idea of us as spoiled brats with the, you know, with Mama Rose's, you know, stage moms, like, that's a stereotype, and it's completely wrong. And it frustrates me that I think that I bought into that for too long. And so now I think I'm kind of, you know, doing penance and trying to understand, you know, where people come from and being empathetic to that experience, because it's more complicated than people think and it's different than what people think.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it makes sense to me too. You don't ever, it's so funny reading your book, because I know you brought that up a lot in your book and in a lot of interviews you've done and a lot of articles you've written too. And we've really researched the hell out of you, by the way. It's not so creepy.
I'm glad. Sometimes I'm like, is anybody reading the stuff I write? And it's nice to know that people are.
Oh, all the former kid actors.
Yeah. Shouting into the void. Yeah. That's
I actually don't think enough former kid actors. Like, there's a therapy session hosted by Mara that every former kid actor needs to go through. Like, it should be required reading your book.
Dude, I'm always thinking, like, and this is, I think, another reason why I want to get into film, because, like, if I ever work with child actors, what I'm going to tell them is, listen, I'm not just your writer, your director. I'm also going to be a force in your life. You're going to check in with me every 6 months. You're going to tell me how you're doing. You're going to tell me what you're doing. I'm not going to judge you. I just want to know, because I just want to make sure that somebody is keeping track of you.
We're so on the same page there. That's something I'm preaching all the time. Yeah. That follow-up, that mentorship. Like, there's a certain responsibility I do feel of people on sets that are participating in projects that have child actors to do that follow-up. Because there's a common denominator with child actor parents.
Yeah. Where
if you allow your kid to get into child acting, there's already something there. And not every case. Your parents seem incredibly well-adjusted and maybe the exception to the rule. But there's some type of common denominator. I mean, it's not regular. Not every single parent out there allows their kid to get into child acting.
Yeah. I mean, I think of how many kids I knew growing up who had parents who were addicts and addicts who were struggling a lot. You know, I think of that. That's something that I saw a lot of. I also saw people who were struggling with a lot of money problems. And I also saw a lot of parents who wanted to be their kid's best friend. And my parents were like, no, we're your parents. You're supposed to think we're uncool.
Did you meet my mom? Is that who you're talking about right now? Wait, but it's something to speak to that for that last point you guys were just making. I mean, I've always thought, you know, whether people in the entertainment industry realize it or not, when you hire a kid actor, particularly for a movie or TV show, that could have a really lasting impact on their lives and their, you know, not just their careers, but on their actual life. I don't know if they realize that from the kid actor's perspective, at least my own, I feel like I can definitely speak for some friends, but for sure for my own, there's a certain responsibility you might not realize that you take on with this kid actor, because I to this day, I feel connected to certain people I worked with when I was a kid that I haven't spoken to in 25 years, but they changed my life, whether they realized it or not. And I will feel connected to them. And so it would be nice if someone said, you know what, I'm not just going to say goodbye at the wrap party. I'm going to continue on, you know, your life. And obviously it's not a lifetime commitment, but that there is an understanding that that is also how you affect children, you know, when you're working with them, you know, it becomes something way in their personal life.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, there are people that are still in my life who are really important to me. Some of them I recently reconnected with, and I don't know if I would have if I hadn't written this book. I mean, I think that it wasn't that I didn't want to reconnect with them. I think it was just that I was kind of like, oh, these were people in my past, you know, but I've made an active effort to do that. Like the acting teacher that I had as a kid who mostly worked with child actors, I met up with last year, and it was an emotional experience because, you know, he was there for me when my mom died. And he was somebody that I'd gone through so much emotional stuff with. And he keeps trying to say, like, you need to do more acting. And I'm like, maybe, maybe not. I don't know. You know, I do voiceover, you know, but that's something. And like my studio teacher, the studio teacher that I had when I was in Toronto, because I don't know about you guys, but I spent so much time in Toronto when I was a kid.
Yeah. For me, it was like, Vancouver.
I was going to say it was Toronto or it was Vancouver. You were one or the other. And then in the 90s and the 2000s, like, I consider Toronto like my college town now.
Yeah.
Because I spent so much time there and I miss it so much. And it's funny because I was touring there a couple years ago with this like horror podcast show that I do, Welcome to Night Vale, which has a huge cult following. And so we've sold sold out shows like all around the world. Like it got this like following on Tumblr in like 2012, 2013. And now it's like enormous. And they've written books based on it. And the books have been, you know, New York Times bestsellers. And it's like a horror comedy. It's based in a town where every conspiracy theory is true. and just like regular things. So there's a dog park, and there's these hooded figures in the dog park, and dogs aren't allowed in the dog park, and neither are people. And there's strange lights that appear above the Arby's, and there's like, there's angels that reveal themselves to people, but angels don't exist. But there really are angels. And it's just everything. And it's a guy doing like a community radio station. Yeah. And he starts this romance with a scientist who comes to town to investigate all the weird goings on there. And it's super weird. And so I play the faceless old woman who secretly lives in your home. and I was like, do you want me to do an old woman voice? They were like, no. So I was like 25 when I started playing this part, and I sounded like I was 25. I mean, I've always had kind of like a B. Arthur Lowe, you know, voice, but they were like, no, we want you to sound like you. And I was like, okay. So I sounded 25 when I was doing this part, and I had a lot of fun recording it. And I recently did an audiobook with them, but we went to Toronto a couple of years ago, and we stayed in like the busiest part of Toronto that was like, I can't remember what the square is called, but it's like their Times Square. And I was like, I love this city so much. It's my favorite. And they were like, you love this city? And I was like, guys, we're not in the best part right now. Yeah. We're in the really weird part of it, but there's so much cool stuff to do. There's a great music scene. There's a great comedy scene. There's, you know, a great food scene. There's like, it's so diverse. You know, I was like, it's so cool. There's a great gay community. There's a great Jewish community. There's like great Ethiopian food. I was like bragging about it. And then they got there and they were like, we liked Montreal more.
Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah.
And when you went on this trip, did you reconnect with a set tutor from Toronto?
Some of them. Yeah. My set tutor, I don't think it was when I did that, but I did a con a couple years ago in Toronto. And I called up my set teacher, Lori, who was wonderful. She'd originally worked with Lisa Jacob, who is like my big sister, who worked on Mrs. Doubtfire with us. And I told her that I met her and she like changed my life. She's in my book a lot. And she was life changer. And I told her, I was like, I'm going to be in Toronto. I need to see you. And I saw her and we just hugged and hugged because she had this like, she was like a motherly, grandmotherly kind of figure to me. And like, we went to a bookstore the next day and we picked out a bunch of books and we just talked. And now we've been catching up with each other during the lockdown because it's really hard. And especially if you're getting older, like if you're over 60 in lockdown right now, you probably aren't going to be able to do a lot of things. So, you know, I talk to her and she tells me about her dogs and I tell her about my cats and we talk about writing, we talk about reading, and it's so nice. But there were a couple of years where I just didn't talk to her. And now I go back and I think writing this definitely made me want to go back and thank all the people that I talked to.
That's so nice.
It helped me.
That's really nice. I mean, you seem to really have, you know, I think there's an assumption that it's like the wild, wild west for kid actors on sets and within the entertainment industry in terms of like finding people that are kind and thoughtful and caring and nurturing to young kid actors. But you seem to have found a lot, or at least, I mean, I don't have one set tutor that I think I could hit up to be like, yo, you look great. Like, they're all interchangeable, quite honestly. And I was kind of like, some were wonderful. Like there is one person that sticks out, but I would never feel the urge to go reach out to him because I think we maybe worked together for like 3 weeks or something.
Yeah. No, I had Richard and Lori, who were both some of the best teachers I've ever had, who were—
Did you work with them multiple times?
I did. I think that after a while I had enough, like I didn't realize that I had clout, but I did. And so I had enough clout. I worked on this one teacher. I had a great teacher on Doubtfire too. And I also think that it's when you do films, you tend to work with people longer. But on Miracle on 34th Street, I worked with this teacher, Richard Wickland, and he was wonderful and he really understood me, and I would be really frustrated with things and he would understand, and he knew that I was like an intense perfectionist, and you know, and so there were times where I would get frustrated or argue about things, but he would always be very patient and understanding. So I really liked him, and my mom, I think, really liked him too. And my mom loved anybody who could tell a good story, and Richard was full of them. So he was great. And I worked with him after that, Matilda. And I don't think I worked with him. No, Simple Wish, we mostly filmed in, we mostly filmed when school wasn't happening. So, oh no, I had another teacher on A Simple Wish. I remember that now. And she was good too. That was a hard part of my life. So I kind of commend her for sticking around during that, because I was not in the best place. But yeah, he was with me on a bunch of film sets and I loved having him there. He was really, it was good to have that constant in my life. And I think that that was something that my parents realized was important too, having constants in your life. Yeah, and I do want to talk more about this because did you guys feel safe on sets mostly? Or would you say that it was uncomfortable or?
I felt generally good, but I started a little bit older than both of you. So I started at 12 and both of you started very young. So, yeah. It was a bit of a different experience. I don't know what it was like for Chris.
Yeah, I felt very safe. I mean, I don't know if I ever felt like in danger. I felt like a lot of stuff was over my head the majority of the time, quite honestly. And I felt like I really knew what to do when the cameras were rolling. The whole rest of the time, I was really unsure of what was happening, quite honestly. But you, Mara, you know, you in your book, and as I knew you when you were young, and as you've seen yourself in interviews when you were a kid, you've struck me in two major ways. You've always seemed to have no issue whatsoever with speaking your mind, in a really good way. I don't mean it like that. That's usually used in context of like someone who's like, you need to hear my opinion. I don't mean it like that. I mean like you just had no problem if you were frustrated with something saying, I don't know, I don't understand that, or that makes me uncomfortable, or what do you mean by that? Like you just had never had a problem, it seems, in your life saying how you felt. And that's really, that's really wonderful. And you seem to, for me in particular, I found a lot of settings within the entertainment industry, whether it was audition waiting rooms or agent meetings or, I don't know, like even hanging out with a group of kid actors and all of their moms or dads, I found a lot of those situations intimidating. And so I tended to just be very quiet. You know, I tended not to say much, quite honestly.
Yeah. I mean, I think that was definitely something that I get from my mom. My mom was, you know, outspoken to a fault sometimes, but speaking my mind and saying, you know, my piece has always been something that I've also always been kind of like compulsively sincere. Like I can't lie and I can't say that I'm okay with something when I'm not, or I can, but then later on I'll get pissed and resentful, which is something. And that's another thing too. Like the idea of being a people pleaser definitely, I think is something that most child actors have. And that's something that I struggled with a lot too, this is like one of the biggest issues I think for me in my life is I always had to be the good girl. I always had to be the good girl because people were expecting me to behave. And I also knew that people expected child stars to be brats. And so I had a very mean grandmother who would be with me on set sometimes and when other people couldn't. And we all knew that she was really mean, but sometimes if I were misbehaving, she would call me by the names of other child actors that she thought were misbehaving heard. I'm not going to say names, but their names because she'd heard that they were brats and she would be like, yeah, you're being a real so-and-so right now. And
that's so funny. That's
was that exact- mortifying for you?
It was because and it felt awful too because these people were kids. So that was horrible. I remember thinking like that is the worst. That is a horrible thing. Yeah,
that is horrible. I will say not to skip over. You know when I the way you've shared your mom and your relationship to her and who she was, you know is really beautiful in your book and it's really beautiful. I think the way that you've always you know, incorporate her when people ask about your experience as a kid actor, because that is for all of us kid actors, such a big part of our experience is this time with our parents and that connection that we develop with them in these, you know, in this endeavor. But you know, your mom, like in the book, it struck me like the difference between someone like your mom and someone like my mom is, you know, like your mom, you talked about on sets, like she really got along with the director, you know, or she'd get along with one of like a huge movie star or something, you know, and she had, she seemed like she had no problem being like, look, there's no way I'm kissing your ass. There's no way I'm just, and I'm not going to be intimidated with you because your name's on all the billboards. If I like you, I like you. If I don't, I don't. And it's cool. It's not like we have to be best friends. She just seemed like she had a really cool, normal, wonderful head on her shoulders. But like my parents in particular, my mom, everything scared her. And I think she wasn't a scared person, but I think she was very, very eager to get people to like her, to make sure that we were doing it all okay. So I inherited that impression. I inherited the like, you know, a little of like, okay, I just need to be professional and talk, you know, and
yeah. That's the typical combination, right? Where the parent and the child are both trying to get everyone on set to like them. And that's not a good recipe. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. It's not. Yeah. People always say, like, people think of stage parents and they think of somebody really overbearing and pushy who is living vicariously through their child. They think of Mama Rose from Gypsy, you know? Yeah. And I'm like, no, there isn't one kind of stage parent. There are many kinds of stage parents. And one that I keep coming across is the timid stage parent. Yeah. You know, I feel like that was something that I hear. I interviewed a couple of actors, a few former child actors, like a year or two ago for a potential piece for, I think, well, I'm not going to say who it was because it eventually kind of fell through, but they, you know, and they were like, yeah, I wish my parents had advocated for me more because they were just more like, oh, okay, my kid's going to work extra hours. Oh, okay. And that was a thing, but there needs to be, you know, but I think my mom had a good balance because she wasn't pushing me. She was kind to me. She wasn't pushing me, but she also wasn't timid. If the director was doing something that she didn't like, you know, she would speak up.
Yeah.
And I think my mom also thought that she was smarter than a lot of people, and she probably was.
She probably was. Yeah, she absolutely was. And you could see that. That's what I got this impression of. I got this impression that your mother was on this set thinking like, good, I'm glad all you people are dedicating your lives to making these movies and blah, blah, blah. But also I am anchored completely to real life while I'm here and I can see through it all.
No, go on. I was going to say my mom was also a big cinephile, which I didn't really realize until a couple of years ago. And I was like, oh yeah, I saw a lot of really classic movies when I was young because she loved them because that was her favorite thing. Like these are, so she knew a lot more about like filmmaking and the art of filmmaking than probably a lot of people did.
Do you think that probably then had a bearing on you wanting to be an actor?
Yeah. I mean, I think I think it did a little bit. I think honestly though, probably what it was the most was like, we were like musical theater nerds, you know, I loved singing and I mean, dancing, I was always terrible at, and I'm still terrible at, but I think we were a very wordy family and we were a very literary family. But there was something very theatrical about my mom and some of my older brothers as well. I got that sort of sensitive theatricality, you know, and I wanted to sing and I wanted to tell stories. And I think that really what it was about for me was I was always telling stories and performing them. I was always performing these like epic little, you know, one woman show play dramatic, you know, like epic sagas, you know, stories that went on for months and months and months. And my parents would always, that's why like my, I write about this in my book, I would start a story and eventually I would like be at the dinner table or something. And I would be like, once upon a time, and my brothers would go, oh, good story, and applaud and cut me off because it was just, because my stories never ended.
They never
yeah, but that's what it was. For me, it was all about telling stories and it was all that kind of theatricality. That was something that I really craved and I really loved. And it wasn't, well, I think I didn't actually become a cinephile until I went away to college and I started dating somebody who was a film major. And you meet somebody who's a film major at NYU, they're going to know a lot about film.
That sounds fun. Yeah.
And that was my first.
Better than actually going through the classes probably is just dating somebody. Just give me the highlights. Exactly. I just want the good stuff.
Exactly. I remember his mom calling once and he was a Jersey boy like you, Chris. So, you know, mom wasn't far away. And I remember her calling and being like, and he was like, oh, I'm kind of having a date night with Mara right now. She's like, oh, are you guys out somewhere? And he was like, no, we're watching The Godfather. And
I was like, just literally going to say, no, mom, we're watching The Godfather. I'm not kidding.
Exactly. And she was like, oh, horses' heads. That's real romantic stuff.
That's so funny.
There's one thing I didn't want to gloss over because I'd just like to hear your opinion on this, Mara, which is as it pertains to parents on set, how much of it, of knowing these things, knowing how to act in this space that for a lot of parents they have no experience in, is their responsibility to figure out. Like, where does the onus lie on, you know, the parents knowing what power they wield, how they should wield that power, instinctually should they just be aware because they are a parent? You know, what's your take on that?
That's a really good question. I think that, you know, you do need to think about your own personality type and your own, you know, the way that you are. as a parent, I think that that's something to think about also before you get into acting. It's kind of like, I mean, this is a bit of a weird analogy, but it's kind of like if you get a dog, you should look into what kind of dog you're getting, because some are going to fit your lifestyle and some aren't. You know, if you travel a lot, you shouldn't get a needy dog. If you, you know, if you, you shouldn't get like a, you know, a toy breed if you have small children, because the dog will be scared of them, things like that. It's sort of like, if you want to get into acting with your child, there's so many different things to consider. And I do think personality type is a lot of it too. One of it is, you know, your kid, is your kid going to be able to handle rejection well, but also, yeah, are you able to be assertive? I think that being assertive is the most important thing, because being aggressive and being pushy about your child being famous isn't, that's not going to be good for your child or for you. And being passive on set is dangerous too.
Yeah, right. Being passive is really.
I just had this idea that there should be like professional chaperones. Okay. It's a whole industry unto itself where you hire them and they're advocating for, they're hired by the child actor to advocate for them on set to know the ropes of what's safe. Cause everyone else on the set in the production's like, no, we need to get the stunt. No, we need to do thing. No, we need to work longer hours. But to have a professional chaperone advocating for the child in a way that the parent wouldn't know because they haven't been on 1,000 sets already. It's like, it's their first time too. So they don't know what to expect or understand. It'll probably never happen, but
it'll never happen.
I feel like I could do that job.
you would crush it. Oh, you'd be incredible.
I'd be like, this isn't okay. Yeah. And it's sad because I mean, I've thought for a long time now that, especially since like intimacy coordinators are now on set more and things like that. I'm like, we should have people on set who are for child advocacy. And who are social workers or something along those lines, you know, who can be like, hey, this isn't right. Or make sit down with the kid and be like, are you sure that this is okay with you?
Did you ever have that in any capacity? Did any set tutor or producer or
definitely
or somebody sort of step in? Yeah,
definitely. I think that my tutors were like that. My studio teachers were definitely like that on a lot of my sets, especially after my mom died, because my dad, you know, had a full-time job and was raising 5 kids. And so he couldn't always be there with me, but I usually had other people there too. And, you know, sometimes I would have like nannies or people who were kind of there so they could like get an extra role and get a SAG card. Sometimes I had people who were, you know, who were very, like very good at advocating for me. And I'm very glad that I had that. You need somebody to be, you know, you need somebody to be able to say no. Yeah. I think that's really important.
I want to go into that in a little more detail in a minute with something you wrote about in your book. But I just want to throw in, you know, I remember it just certainly struck me. Like there was a couple times where crew members, I remember because my mom was a little more timid and because she was it was a little easy for, if they said, hey, look, we're supposed to release him in 45 minutes, but do you think we could just keep him like one extra hour? It was always like, that was the question. And there was a crew member, this guy was really sweet. I remember he was like, hey guys, you don't got to do that. You know that, right? and had no problem saying it for the whole set to hear. And I feel like there was a, you know, you could find that. It wasn't always just like this, I don't know, this overbearing ask, you know, of productions.
I remember there was one set I was on where somebody's mom asked if I could change around my schedule so she could go have Thanksgiving with her family. And that would have been something that I think I would have been okay with if I hadn't also not been spending Thanksgiving with my family.
Yeah.
And then she, you know, and I was in another country at the time and I was 12. You know, I was living abroad without my parents, without any kind of family, and I was fine, you know. And then we like had a Thanksgiving dinner and she like did this huge guilt trip there saying that it was the first time without her family in so long. And I was just kind of like, and now I like feel bad about that because I'm like, maybe I should have just let her go. But also she was putting all that pressure on a 12-year-old.
Totally. Yeah. Exactly. That's the big thing is like you're asking kids to vouch for things or make decisions on things that they're actually not capable of making decisions on. They're not prepared to do it. Kids are naturally inclined to want to be agreeable, to do the right thing, to, you know, be nice human beings.
Yeah.
And they're just perpetually vulnerable. And you know, and it's amazing to have great set tutors that can stick up for you, but
that's not always the case. No.
Yeah, it's not always the case. Sometimes the set tutors just show up and are on their phone the whole time and aren't really, and I don't, that's not meant to put a mark on set tutors, because there's a lot of great ones, but just like in any profession, there's people that just show up for the paycheck.
My mom said that there were times when, you know, one of my brothers was acting, that there was one movie that they were on and he was only there for the day. And the woman kept saying, I can't wait until this is over so I can go shopping. I really want to go shopping. I really need to go shopping today. I can't wait till this is over so I can get shopping. And finally my mom said, you know what? Go shopping. I'll teach him. Yeah. Go shopping.
Yep. I definitely remember quite a lot of tutors, because I imagine it's a weird thing to get into if you're a teacher. Like, I don't know if you're exactly looking to be a teacher or if you're exactly looking to be a set tutor. I feel like a lot of people might fall into
it. It should be like the SWAT team of teachers. Like, these are the best teachers, because you got to deal with some shit. There's some real stuff you got to know how to do. You can't – typically it's like – again, not to put a mark in them, it's like the not so great teachers that kind of wind up there. You need the superstars.
It's like people who've lived like, in my experience, it was usually people who lived like wild lives, like all kinds of crazy adventures. And and then we're like, and then I thought I'd do this. And I was like, okay, that's a lot of former hippies. I had a lot of former hippies with a lot of musicians.
I remember, because I played guitar, so the teachers would want to just talk about guitar only, like school. No, screw that. Let's just watch videos of, like, you know, Chuck Berry, like learning Chuck Berry licks.
Yeah, it's strange, because, you know, what people maybe don't realize is, you know, those teachers are there all day long as well. So they're getting paid for a full day, but really they're only working with you for 2 to 3 hours a day. Yeah. And so the rest of the time they're hanging out, eating free food and just chill. I don't know what they're doing alone. It can attract a certain type of either slothful or, I don't know, like a person who isn't, you know, who is bothered by sitting around for 10 hours a day.
You also have to have thick skin too, because when the teacher, if let's say you are a teacher that really stands up for the kids' rights, what's best for your pupil. Mm-hmm. When you walk onto that set, you're hated.
Yeah, because that's true.
Everybody doesn't want you there. They don't want you meddling, messing up their day, screwing around with stuff. There's a lot of money on the line and all that. So, like, you've got to have thick skin. You've got to be okay with that, with being the antagonist too, which is another, back to the SWAT team thing. It's another skill set you got to have.
Yeah. I think I was very lucky. And I think that my parents realized that these were teachers who were willing to advocate for me. And that's why they kept hiring them and personally requesting them, because it was, they knew, they were like, they're going to be doing, you know, they're going to be doing a lot of hard work, and they're going to be the, you know, they're going to be the one to say no. And so that I think is, and I really wish there were more, like, it's so interesting to me hearing, or not even interesting, really horrifying, hearing stories from the 70s and 80s, because it just seems like so unregulated and wild on film sets. Yeah. And everybody I know who was an actor then has these crazy stories and stories that I'm just like, 10 years later, we wouldn't have gotten away with that. And I think the 90s and 2000s, we had a little bit more, people realized like, oh, yeah, we need to make sure that this isn't happening. We need to be more conscious about it. I think there was a little bit more of that, because I feel like most people I know that were actors in the 90s and 2000s we were a little better off, I think. We benefited a lot from the lessons.
We were protected more, and I think too, I think the structure of the entertainment industry became more, it solidified, you know? It's like the way that they made TV shows and movies, it was a bit of the Wild Wild West in the 60s, 70s, and even 80s. And then it started to really become a big, you know, a big money-making industry, and independent films had to start making them in certain ways. I think the unions got stronger. So I think a lot of former kid actors definitely benefited from, you know, a more thoughtful, regulated process.
And especially for us, like in Mara, you were mentioning working, your parents liked you working in not kids' films, but films that were for family audiences or younger audiences, right? And I did a lot of work that was in that genre as well. And in the 70s and 80s, it was like a forgotten space. There was no money to be made there. So low production value, low budgets. And that all changed in the 90s and 2000s. I don't know if it was, you know, Macaulay Culkin that springboarded that out into the stratosphere with like Home Alone or something. But it became big, big content. These are mega films now. So that changed too, when there was more money to throw at it and more exposure. Things got better for young performers, especially when it came to family content and kids content.
Yeah, I definitely think that's true. I mean, and I think that, although I will say that I got a lot of flack for being in some not so great family movies. And that I think is, and that was a lot from critics, especially. Like, people are always saying like, oh, it must have been so bad for you in Hollywood, must have been so bad for you in Hollywood. And I'm like, no, actually, Hollywood wasn't the bad part. I mean, I was sort of hidden and kept from a lot of that. It was really the media and people who call themselves fans, but were creeps and stalkers. That was the problem. And that's a separate thing than Hollywood.
Yeah, and that Hollywood really can't control, has very little control over, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Producers and studios and directors and other actors, like that's a whole other facet of the entertainment industry that you just don't have any control over.
People will be like, Hollywood is so sick feeding us, creepy things, or like sexualizing girls. And I'm like, okay, but the thing is, Hollywood is all about supply and demand. It is, it's capitalism, pure and simple. It's that it is at its heart, like the most capitalist thing. It's what do people want? We're going to give it to them, mm-hmm. So, and Hollywood is not immoral. It's amoral. It doesn't think about it. It thinks about what sells. And that's just the way that it is. We can try to change that. But the thing is that it has a lot to do with the public. And I don't think that people realize, like, the public dictates. Like, there are so many movies that have been made in the past few years because the public has demanded it. Or different director's cuts of movies have come out because, people have demanded it. And in some ways, I think that's great, because it's like, wow, these people have power over it. But also, I think they don't realize just how much flimsy power they have.
Exactly. And who they rail against at times. It always seems, I'm like, do you realize you're talking to a pretty dispassionate group of people? Like, they don't actually, the thing that offended you so much, they didn't really care about that to begin with.
Never read the script.
They didn't even know what was happening. So I know it seems like they made this really thoughtful, conscious decision that is awful of them, but they're like, we don't care either way. Sorry, that happened. That's more the reaction.
So like, I feel like the most, it's funny because I've always told people, like, in the past few years, I've been saying that the most Hollywood show out there is Veep, which isn't about Hollywood at all. It's about Washington. Yeah. But the whole thing there is that kind of nobody knows what they're doing, and it's all about appearances, and it's all about incompetence, and it's all about money and power. But everybody's just really ridiculous and stupid and incompetent and has huge egos. And I'm just like, this is what Hollywood is like.
That is what Hollywood's like.
Yeah. LA is way more like DC than it is like New York.
I mean, I'm thinking about, there's a good South Park episode where Cartman comes up with a superhero franchise that he wants to pitch.
Oh, yeah.
And he calls up Netflix, and Netflix is this huge floor of cubicles and all these people answering phones like at a feverish pace, at like a Wall Street pace. And the one guy just picks up the phone and goes, "Welcome to Netflix. You're greenlit. What's your show about?"
I heard that.
And then all of a sudden he's hearing Cartman's pitch for this superhero franchise. And then someone goes, "Oh my God, I've got a show about transgender dragons." And then everybody hangs up the phone on whoever they're talking to.
Yeah.
And they're like, "We got a hit." And that's it.
Yeah.
And you're like, yeah, that is a good portrait of maybe how things work in the entertainment industry.
Mara, another thing that Chris and I have talked about, but I'm really curious to get your perspective on, is, and this is on media being a part of the problem here, with kid actors or with people in the public eye, there's a certain expectation that you're going to have things written about you or photos taken and things like that. But for kid actors, it's this unique space where you were a performer at one time. You were in the public eye at one time. Now you're an adult and you've moved on with your life, and you're doing, for those folks that are doing something else. But yet media and journalists, people are still interested in what's happening in their lives. At what point does your life become your own again and it no longer belongs to the public? And it's specific for kid actors because they, for some of them, never made the decision to become a public figure in the first place.
Yeah. I mean, I had no idea what I was signing up for. And my parents never wanted me to be famous. And I never wanted to be famous. I didn't know what it was to be famous. I was five. No five-year-old has a conception of what fame is. And I remember when I thought about what it would be like to be famous, I was kind of indifferent to it. I was like, I don't know, that might be okay. But the thing is that I feel like you kind of can't ever really get out of it. You know, it is a bit Hotel California. You know, you can never leave. But you can never leave. And that I think is just, but you just kind of have to accept that. And I mean, the truth is that I spent a lot of years saying, I don't want to be famous. I'm never going to do anything that has to be, you know, that has to do with fame ever again. I'm never going to do anything that has anything to do with entertainment ever again. But I kind of had to realize, like, well, no, I mean, I still love working in theater, and I still want to write, and I still want recognition. And I mean, I had to kind of find a balance. Like, I'm not an A-lister, and I'm very happy with not being an A-lister. I think that for me, that would feel too vulnerable. And I think that's part of the reason why I don't really act in films anymore. Or if I do any on-screen acting, it's like very small stuff. But also I have to keep in mind that a lot of this is because I was, you know, it's a smaller pond when you're a kid. And I looked a certain way, and I had like a good ear for dialogue when I was a kid. I don't think that I was the greatest child actor ever, but I think that I had some skills that lent themselves to decent performances and doing well on film sets. But I think that...
That's a very humble way of putting it.
I try to be humble. I try to be humble, and I try to be like, I'm always questioning myself. And so
can I give another compliment real fast? I just want to give this comment. I think the magic of you as a writer and as a full, whole, healthy adult is very similar to what was so nice about you as an actress as a kid, which I think is that you have a depth that's very obvious, and you have a way of penetrating honesty in your presence. And I don't know what else, it's a weird way to put it, but like you do. And I can hear it in your writing, and it was very much came across when you were on screen as a kid. So, you know, that I don't think it was just an ear for dialogue or, you know, a small toolkit as an actor. I think that there's a quality about you that is there in your acting as a kid that obviously has shined as an adult in many ways too.
And, well, thank you. I mean, I think that I had like a compulsive, like I've said before, compulsive sincerity. I was painfully honest. And it's interesting because a couple years ago I talked to Michael Ritchie's daughter, and he was a director I worked with who was a wonderful, kind man. Like anytime I read, and he was this incredibly tall man with like white hair and a white beard. And I realized afterwards that every time I was reading a book about where there was like a wise wizard, I always imagined Michael Ritchie. Like as a kid, that's like what he was, this like archetype to me. But his daughter told me, said, you know, my dad said he loved working with you because you were so sincere and you were so honest. And that's something that you don't see in a lot of actors, especially not a lot of child actors. And I was like, oh yeah, I guess I was. But you know, the funny thing is that I feel, and I don't know if you guys ever feel like this, but I feel like I feared for a really long time that I had lost my ability as an actor, because I felt like growing up was kind of like in every like book about growing up, or like YA book or like children's book about growing up, there's a loss of innocence there. You know, like you don't go back to Neverland. You can't go back to, you know, to Narnia. Your demon's shape doesn't change anymore. It stays fixed. There's all of these like, you know, different analogies for a loss of innocence as you grow up. And sometimes it's seen as a good thing, and sometimes it's seen as a bad thing. But for me, I think that like I would try to act in high school classes and college classes, and I would have a lot of trouble with it because I was so afraid to let myself be vulnerable. Because fame had changed me, because these people had changed me, because I felt like there were a lot of people that I couldn't trust, and I couldn't let myself be really open with people. And that's a problem that I've had in my own life. Like it's made dating nearly impossible, but also it's made it, I think that it definitely affected my acting for so many years, because I couldn't let myself be as open as I was when I was a child.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked to a lot of former kid actors, and I think we can definitely, you know, obviously just speak for ourselves, but I think there is a commonality with kid actors as they continue to act into their teenage years and young adulthood, where it's like, there's like an old Bruce Lee quote where he's like, first you learn how to kick, you just kick. And then you learn the mechanics of the kick, where your hips go, where your eyesight is, where your shoulders are supposed to lean, at which way you can make the kick stronger. And all he goes, and then your whole job after that is to learn that a kick is just a kick.
Right.
And there's something to that process, I think, for a lot of former kid actors, especially ones like you that are very, very talented, where you do have a particular amount. You're not just like selling toys and commercials, you know, you're telling deep emotional journeys with characters and deep stories. And so there is this strange process where all of a sudden one day, and I relate to this completely, where all of a sudden one day you show up and you're kind of an adult and someone's like, act, and you're like, I don't know how. Yeah. Or like, you're like, I don't know what, okay, did I know what I was doing before, or do I not? And it's weird. It's really strange. And it's very, I think it does stop you from being vulnerable. And I think you say something with, you know, I don't know if you know, but you touch on the expectation of other people too, right, that you do know what you're doing. Yeah. That they're like, hey, like I did this film when I was like 13 or 14 where I like played a kid with Tourette syndrome and I was a jazz pianist, and it was like a really complicated story and a complicated character. And then a few years later, I remember someone had seen it and I auditioned for something and they like totally thought I could play like this blind kid. And they're like, can't you just do it? And I was like, what? No, that's so complicated. And part of it was it was so hard to be vulnerable when someone expected me to be able to do something that quite honestly I did more so out of just like a raw talent and vulnerability than I did because I knew what I was doing. I had no idea what I was doing.
I had a really good acting teacher, I think, but like when I went away to school, and it's funny because I didn't get any big parts in high school. I went to an arts high school and I studied theater, but I didn't get any big parts until the last semester of my senior year. And I was there for 2 years. I had like a few small parts, but when I was there, I realized, I was like, oh shit, everybody here is a really good actor. And that was a really good performance, I think, that I did, you know, at that age, especially. And it was a complicated play. It was a John Guare play. And I mean, that's the guy who wrote Six Degrees of Separation and like a lot of really weird, complicated stuff. And I was playing a really vulnerable part. I was playing a sick, old, eccentric woman. And I remember when the director said to me, you know, I think you would be good for this part, I had a panic attack. Because I was like, I can't do this. I can't do this at all. But I think that it was probably because I knew everybody at school and I knew everybody I was working with and I trusted everybody that I was able to do that performance. So it was a small school. I did that performance and I got compliments from everybody on campus. And people were like, Mara, you were really amazing in this part. And I still think about it all the time, because I think that at that point in my life, I was like, I'm just not a good actor anymore. And you know, and then I got to college, and in college, I just slept through my acting classes. You know, there was a lot of self-sabotage going on there, because then I was really scared, and it was supposed to be like, you know, oh, it's one of the top acting schools in the country. And it's funny too, because the Olsen twins were there for a while at the same time. And so was Haley Joel Osment. And we would like see each other and make eye contact, but not talk. And it was funny because I'd met both of them before. I were all three of them before, but it just felt like it was too weird for us, I think, at the time. We would just look at each other and we would like acknowledge each other and then just look away. So
that is so strange.
I wish
connect.
You guys started a club of some kind.
I know. You know, my friend Rachel Bloom, who she does Crazy Ex-Girlfriend and a bunch of really amazing stuff. I met her at NYU, and she said, and I think like our senior year, or maybe like the year after, she was like, oh yeah, I'm friends with Haley. We're in some classes. I'd love to write a rap battle between the two of you.
That's really funny.
It's too bad we've been deprived of this.
I know. Yeah. I know. It is kind of
but
sad.
Yeah, that is very strange. There is.
And also knowing that she would have written it
would have been
freaking amazing.
She's brilliant. She's a genius. Yeah. So yeah.
Wow. But it is so strange in college, because you guys do belong to a very particular, special, unique path in life of being all very successful, known kid actors and who had very big career defining roles. You know, there's a lot of kid actors that might have been successful. You guys had roles that people remember.
It may have been the most rare grouping of human beings ever to have passed each other in a quad ever.
Yeah. People
and that you guys didn't.
Yeah, this was NYU, so we didn't have a quad. We had Washington Square Park. But yes, I remember being like in line in the dining hall, and like Haley being a few spots above me, and like him looking back at me and looking and like us like locking eyes for a second, and then being like, oh, we can't do this.
What stopped you?
It was like two of the people were watching. It's like living in
Did you feel like people were waiting? Yeah, right.
They were.
People
were waiting. They were. And in fact, there was a Facebook group at the time called like NYU Where Child Stars Come to Die.
I was just about to ask you about that because I read that you wrote that. And I was like, why is that a thing?
Well,
for that reason, is it because you and Haley and the Olsen twins?
Yeah, and the Olsen twins were all there. And you know, it wouldn't have bothered me so much, except the guy who started it was this kid who was like very clearly like a millionaire. Like he was one of those like rich kids who comes from Connecticut and has three last names like as first names, you know. His name was like
Jake Ryan Lawrence.
But not even that. It was like you know, Rutiger, you know. it would be like, you know, Rutiger, Wheatley, Stonefield.
Yeah, the oldest, like the oldest slave owner names you can think
exactly
of.
Exactly. Yeah. And like, and he and like the third, I think there was like the third or the fourth, you know. And he was like you know, head of the College Republicans and like had gone to this like elite prep school. And I was like, okay, dude, I'm from the valley, you know. I'm lower middle class. I didn't grow up the way that you did. And he's posting all this stuff about like, you know, sorry that we didn't learn that our $1 million smiles. And I'm like, you're not exactly working class hustling, you know. You're not exactly
your childhood really sucked.
You're not like a black kid from the South Bronx, you know. You're doing just fine. Don't be resentful for me.
I was about to say you got it. That's such a cheap shot, and also it's such like such painfully disgusting, insecure, low hanging fruit for somebody to do. But it's also
we are easy targets.
Easiest targets. And I say something because I want to launch into your book while we still have time with you too. And there's something I think the biggest thing in your writing that I like, I was reading and then my wife heard me from the other room go, yeah. And she goes, what just happened? And I said, I want to read this to you. And I read it out loud to her. And it's this, you talk in this book, and this is by no means defining of your book. Your book is beautiful. Mm-hmm. I think what defines it, for anybody that hasn't read it, you should go read it. And I think what defines it is your really full experience of life and all the facets you explore in this. You explore your, you know, you explore love, you explore loss, you explore sexuality, you explore coming of age, you explore fame, you explore college. You explore like all these things. Mm-hmm. So I don't mean this for this to define it, but you wrote this thing here, and this is in relation to, you said you had read one of those cheap shot like websites, one of those clickbaity, mm-hmm. where are they now, child actor things. And you imagined, I'm going to read it. So I hope you don't feel weird, but only because I just think it's almost like a brilliant monologue of a former kid actor. I just think this should be in the class for former kid actors. Like, this is your future, just so you guys know. And so you said, so the next time someone, be they someone in Hollywood, or more likely, someone hiding behind a username decides to tell me what would make me prettier, I'm going to propose the following. I'll meet them in person, but before they offer any suggestions, I will ask them to listen. I will tell them about going through puberty in the public eye after my mother died of cancer. I will tell them how it feels to find a website advertising nude photos of yourself as a 12-year-old. I will tell them that I've looked at cute from both sides now, and that in both cases, it just made me miserable. I will tell them how fitting in is that the only real acting I do these days is voiceover, where no one can see me, and that one of the characters I play is literally described as faceless. We will talk about the beauty standard, how it's changed throughout history, and how different it is in different countries. We will talk about the fashion industry's exploitation of young models and designers. I will remind them, if they are a woman, how often they are seen as little more than how they look. I will ask them how they have been judged and how much it hurt. I will tell them how much it hurt to experience that kind of criticism on a macro scale, and how free I feel now that I have chosen not to worry about it. And finally, I will look them in the eye and I will tell them how my mother wanted me to prove myself through my actions and skills rather than my looks. And now I believe I have, and I'm happier than ever. And I just think that's like so emotionally moving. I thought I was going to get really excited. I didn't realize I was going to start crying a little bit reading that, but I just think, I just think it's so moving. And I think that is the most beautiful response to that stigma and attitude of the former kid actor that I could ever imagine being said, honestly.
Yeah.
I think it's so brave. It's so nice and brave and beautiful. And I don't know if you've been able to hear people say that to you, but I read it and I was like, I jumped up out of my seat and I was like, yeah, that's it. That's it. And you, in your wonderful, in all of the work I imagine you had to do inside to come to a place where you get to say, I think the thing that really has the potential to destroy young former kid actors, to really send them into a place where like they might never come back from it. Mm-hmm. And you got to go to that place, it seems, or at least know what it looks like and come out a deep, poetic, charming, funny person. And I mean it. And I just think it's so amazing.
Thank you. I mean, I didn't come out unscathed. Like, I was talking to some friends recently about like dating and like I can't really do dating apps because I have a public face and because I don't want people to know where I live, you know? Yeah. And like, I did like OkCupid like 10 years ago and nothing really happened. But also I told them, I was like, it's really hard for me to trust people.
In the book, you talked about the fear of online dating, where you were scared. You're like, what if like Perez Hilton gets some picture? And I read that and I thought, you know, AJ and I lived together. I was 25.
Yeah. 10 years ago, we were both on OkCupid.
We both got on OkCupid. And AJ, I don't know if you remember, but the first like 4 or 5 people that I matched with, the only thing they said to me was, come on, dude, is this a weird catfish where you took that actor's picture and put it here? Or I got like, oh my God, is this really you? And that question was more horrifying because I was like, I can't say yes because what does that say about me? You know, it's like that I'm,
I would not show my face on a lot of them.
Yeah.
And
me too. I started to try to find pictures that were not good pictures and pictures that like made me not look like me. I was like, but this is weird. And then the first match I went on, I showed up to this date. I went out to dinner. And within 5 minutes, this girl was like, hey, that TV show you're on, I really loved it. I just had it. I was like, no.
That happened to me too. I went on a date with somebody and he was like smirking the whole time. Like he was being really weird. And then eventually I was like, what's going on? He's like, I figured out who you are. And it was like so weirdly self-congratulatory. And it was like, he wasn't listening to anything I said. He didn't laugh at any of my jokes. And maybe I just wasn't being very funny, but he was not. But I was just like, oh, this is like a weird thing for you. This is like a pride thing for you.
You called. That's how I got the sense of this girl. It's like you called a friend and said, I'm going to dinner with that actor guy I saw on that show when I was young. That's the dinner. Well, you had no interest in being here to.
Of course. It's not.
It kind of ties into part of a bigger subject, too, which is when you go out into the world on your own, like you put yourself on a dating app, you're going to represent yourself. You're not representing a character. You're not representing a project. You're not representing Hollywood, you know, because you're doing a press junket or something. You're just being yourself. It's strangely vulnerable for former kid actors. And that's something I experienced when I first went, like my first job as a non-actor. I was a bartender in my early 20s.
Right.
And my ego needed to be checked so hard. I was so scared that somebody was going to recognize me.
Oh my God.
And my world was just going to crumble. Like I just could not survive that.
Well, that's something I think about. Like a couple months ago, I was telling my sister, I was like, I need to do something because I just feel so bored right now. And I think this is true of a lot of child actors. Like we're happier when we're working. No matter what we do, like I just need to be kept busy. And my sister said, well, you know, there's this store near you that's looking for people to shop there. And I thought about it and I was like, do I want to get the job there? And the thing is, there are times in my life where I would have been like, oh my God, working as barista is so embarrassing. But, you know, my parents were always like, it's not below you. Nothing, no work is ever below you. And I thought about it and I was like, you know, maybe I should. And then I was like, oh, but would there be a backlash because I'm taking this job at a local store when, you know, other people should be working there instead, you know? I knew inevitably there would be like a former child actor working at a store, you know, working retail. And I knew there would have been that and I could have dealt with that, but I didn't want to deal with people being like, how dare you take that job away from people who actually need, you know, to feed their families and such.
I actually needed the job too, but that's, but anyway.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it is not touched on enough. I feel like, you know, what's funny is when adult actors go through these things, like I think a couple years ago, it was either Michelle Pfeiffer. I think it was Michelle Pfeiffer that got on a dating app. And it became like a thing and people were like, Michelle Pfeiffer. And she's like, yeah, guys, I'm an adult and I'm single and I want to go on a dating app. Go fuck yourselves. And like that's how it gets dealt with. Or there's the actor that was on the Cosby Show that was working at a grocery store. And that became a thing. Right. And he got shamed and people came to his defense so quickly. They came to that actor and they're like, you know, don't shame artists and don't shame people that are trying to endeavor in a creative field that is really hard to make a living in. And that's, you know, like, and don't shame somebody for doing what they got to do in life. And like the guy's doing a respectable job. He's not, I don't know. He's not like in a Ponzi scheme selling, you know, old people vitamins that really hurt them. You know, like it's something strange, but my point to it, why I even bring it up is people are so quick to come to an adult actor's defense on these things.
Yeah.
I think no one ever comes to a former child actor's defense on these things. I think everybody kind of goes, oh, that sucks. That they shouldn't do that.
Well,
next.
And then the narrative of us is they either love to make fun of us. We're a joke to them because, you know, we got rewarded, they think, for doing the things that, you know, you guys weren't really acting. You were just being cute and you were just, you know, like, I think that there's a lot of bitterness. There's a lot of bitterness because it's like they think that we got awarded for the stuff that they did naturally, you know, like, and they're like, well, we were cute too. We should have gotten it. So there's a little bit of resentment there. But there's also the idea that we're sad, that we're so sad. And the thing is, like, and every now and then people will be like, you turned out so great. And I'm like, okay, but nobody ever really turns out anything. Like, I appreciate you thinking that, but first of all, I don't want to be put in comparison to other child actors because I didn't have their lives. I didn't have their circumstances. And like, you know, my issues, my neuroses and complexes are more of the, like, me taking a long time to write something or act something because I feel really insecure about it. They take that form. They don't take the form and like struggling with dating. They don't take the form of like me doing cocaine, you know? But for some people, that's what they did. They did cocaine. They drank. They did all these things, you know? And and that's the way that their life is because of their, you know, genetic composition, because of their lives, because of their friendships and the people that were around them. Like, I don't know. I mean, everybody is a product of their environment. Everybody is a product of these things. But people love to make us – people love to have us as sad stories.
Yeah, you know? They love it. I think it's that weird fall from grace. Yeah. And there's a weird, like, you know, because we're usually, you think former kid actors can be part of people's childhoods. There's this like, we hold a weird special place for some people. So there's like a particularly juicy shittiness in the train wreck, you know, of like it's like you can see that from like a former model that you saw when they were 20 years old, you know, or a politician, you know, Anthony Weiner that took a picture of his, you know, it's like you can revel in that kind of shit, but when it comes to like seeing a kid, like this thing that really held this particular special little moment in your childhood, you know, it's like it is that to a much larger degree. I think that's why that weird narrative survives.
Well, I also think that we're kind of, I mean, we are sort of seen as objects to them, I think. And like every little girl who had Barbies goes through a phase where she draws on her Barbies, she cuts off their hair, she destroys them. And it's sort of a coming of age thing. It's sort of a rejection of childhood. I mean, like, maybe this is a little pretentious, but I do feel like that's what it is. You know, as you get older, you make fun of the things that you used to like. You know, and then later on you come to embrace them again, I think, sort of as nostalgia. But, you know, there's that time in your life where you're like, that's baby stuff. I don't want that anymore. And I think that especially those of us who are on, you know, child friendly or family friendly TV shows and movies, we kind of are seen as like, we're seen as that too. Like in middle school and high school, I got people being like, why were you in Matilda? That movie sucked. And why were you in this? That movie, you're in shitty kids movies. Ew. Like, you know, I had people say things like that to me. And, you know, and also this being Burbank, people were like, you're not like a real actor. Like Evan Rachel Wood is a real actor. She's in real movies. You know, Dakota Fanning's a real actress. Like you're not really a real actor. And I mean, and those are like incredible actors that I thought were fucking amazing. But like, so there was definitely a little bit of that.
It comes from that place.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why rejection. I got beat up for being in. Yeah, it's why I got beat up for being in Seventh Heaven. My remark to the guys, I said, dude, I was in it and they paid me to be in it, but you watch it. What does that say about you?
I said
and
that
he just
too.
Punched me in the face.
Like,
yeah.
I was in a Disney movie called Balloon Farm that was just a very silly, you know, and I worked with Adam Wiley and Rudy Lipscomb on that. I don't know if you know them, but they were wonderful to work with. We had so much fun on that set, just like playing telephone and playing like we just had a game that was just us coming up with all the names of musicals that we could, which tells you a lot about what kind of kids we were. I think we had such a great time on that set, but I had so many kids making fun of me. They were like, you were in a movie called Balloon Farm. Oh my God, that's so lame. That's so stupid. And I was like, well, what were you doing watching it? And they would be like, I was just flipping channels. Yeah.
And that's exactly, but it does. It speaks that sentiment where you suddenly, your peers are like trying to, you know, distance themselves from childhood things and you're a part of it. So they're distancing themselves from you. And that's weird. Okay, everybody. I snuck it in there, guys. You thought it was missing. I know most of you missed it. Hey, so this is the end of our intermission for our chat with Mara Wilson. That's the end of part one. We'll be back next week with part two. We really hope you enjoyed it. It just keeps getting better and better. So we look forward to sharing the rest with you next week. Thanks so much, everybody. Rate, review, tell a friend, spread the word. And thank you so much for being a part of this with us. We very much appreciate it.